Again, the opportunity to introduce a friend and colleague. Steve Miller is the current UMA president with whom I serve. He is a practicing otolaryngologist in Salt Lake, specializing in pediatric and adult ear, nose, and throat surgery. He's been a member of the UMA for greater than 25 years, served as delegate for many years, and now is, as I mentioned, the president of the association. And he's doing a great job, especially as we look at remodeling the management system of the UMA board. And it's an honor to work with him and to serve with him. He promised he won't be boring. I turn the time over to Steve.
Thank you, Brian, and thank you all for inviting me to come up and speak. It was a wonderful drive up this morning, and I've heard about Ogden surgical and medical meetings going on for 20-some-odd years with my partners. They've talked about it and have been coming up here, and I'm grateful for this opportunity to come and speak before all of you and talk to you about things that you can do to help facilitate what Dr. Epperle was just talking about, which is bringing better health care to the American people. I mean, if we could summarize what he was trying to say and all those different slides, we really want to bring better health care to as many people as we can, and hopefully every American person. So as we talk about what's going on in Utah, keep that in mind, that our goal is, as physicians, as healthcare providers and physician extenders, we have patients that look to us for our help, and we need to find a way to help them to do and feel better. I like this quote from New York best-selling author Kevin Kruse. Life isn't about getting and having. It's about giving and being. And we as physicians need to think about how can we give to others and how can we advocate for our patients and be there for our patients. One of the things that, you know, I'm currently the president of, and Dr. Campbell mentioned to you that he serves on the board with us, is UMA membership is a great thing that you can be a part of. And one of the things that you will get is communication if you're a member, and if you're not a member also. And you'll also get representation on the, I can see why you're standing over there, that light kind of shines right in your eyes, at Capitol Hill, up at the state Capitol building. There are publications that are sent to you, there'll be metabytes that are sent to you, but most importantly, I put the website on there. Please send us your email. If you're not a member, we still want your email, and we'd love to send you information, especially when it comes to bills that are happening up at the legislature. I'll tell you just a quick story. I was in a committee, and I was going to testify before a committee, and we were three physicians of our physician legislatures who were on that committee, Representative Barlow, Red, and Kennedy, fellow physicians that you may know. They, as I was talking to them about this bill that was going to be talked about the next day, one of them said to me, "Do doctors really care about this? Do they really want to have this agreement? Do they really want to oversee what goes on here?" And I said, "Yeah, they want to know, and they want to oversee them." And he says, "Well, but you're the only one that's telling me this. How come others aren't telling me?" So we sent out an email that night, and the next morning, that doctor came to me and said, "I don't know what you did, Steve, but I got barraged with emails from physicians. And so we need your help on a last-minute basis and on a continual basis. So send us your email, see Sylvia, she's at the UMA booth right around the corner, and become a member. Both those things would be great. The next thing to get involved is, let's get involved nationally. We have four congressmen and two senators. I have called this grassroots hotline They'll ask if you want to talk to your senator, or they'll ask you if you want to talk to your congressman. You'll get one of them. You won't get them, but you'll get one of their staff members, and they'll ask you, what do you want to talk about? Which bill do you care about? And how do you feel about it? And then that will be tallied up for them to vote on it. Well, in March, I was able to go to the advocacy meeting back in Washington, D.C. with several other UMA members. And these were some of the issues we talked about with all four of our congressmen and both senators. And I'll tell you that the Utah Medical Association gets an audience with all of them. There are many organizations that may get a staff member, but we got an audience with every one of them. We have a great relationship with them. Medicare Empowerment Act is one you may want to weigh in on. That act is the House bill and Senate bills right there. It allows both patients and physicians to opt in and opt out of Medicare, not just on a yearly basis, which is what the current rule is, but as often as you'd like to. So if you have a patient who wants to see a physician and doesn't want to go through Medicare, they can do it and then still go back to Medicare. If you have a physician who needs to opt out so they can see a patient and do something, they can do that and then come back. It just frees up the healthcare system. So when we talked to the congressmen and senators about this, before we came back to Salt Lake, two of them signed on as co-sponsors of that bill. Both Congressman Bishop and Stewart have signed on. The other two congressmen have not. So those of you who may have those congressmen or senators, you may want to call them and say, hey, what about this? I'm for this. ICD-10 repeal. We talked to them about that. As you know, ICD-11's, well, as you may not know, ICD-10 has been repealed for another year. However, ICD-11 is due to come in 2017. ICD-11 is a lot fewer codes than ICD-10. It's a lot smaller change, and you will be making the change to 10 first in a year and then to 11. There is a bill out there that repeals that and tells them just to wait for 11. GME funding, we don't have enough residency spots for the students that we're finishing. We want to push them on that. And then SGR repeal, which was already discussed, which essentially needs to be taken care of. And Senator Hatch told me, who sits on the Senate Finance Committee, I have a plan. It will be taken care of. Just give me some time. He thought it would be taken care of in March, but it got kicked down the road, but he's still working on it. The next thing to get involved with is more of a local thing that you need to really think about. As you heard, we need to define quality and value. Nobody knows what is quality and what is value. We need to define it for your clinic, for your office, for this state, for your community. If you don't define it, who's going to define it? Whichever administrator or nurse that might get paid to do it. Not that that's going to be bad, but I hear physicians come to me and say, how is this quality? I mean, it doesn't change that we're not going to improve what we're doing for patients by doing this. I mean, all they're doing is keeping track of how long they're waiting in my waiting room. Well, if that's not quality, what is? And you guys need to be part of those committees and help make that decision. Just so you know, this is part of the Utah healthcare reform, that Medicaid accountable care organizations are being formed, and they don't know what quality is. Quality is not yet defined, but their goal is to pay for quality. And you need to be on those committees if you want to have a voice in what quality is. So make sure you're a part of that. There is a task force that you could testify before who's working on the Accountable Care Act implementation. So please be a part of it. Don't sit back and think that I'm just going to see patients and I'm going to do the thing I know best, and if I do that, that's all I care about, because it will come to affect how you're seeing patients if you don't get involved. Another thing that has come up to me in a couple different things, there are many walks of life for physicians that are employed, not employed, part of clinic groups, on their own. Those people who are on their own tend to be involved in their billing practices. Many people tend to just let the corporation or their billing service or whatever bill for them. Remember, you are responsible for Medicare fraud, not whoever's billing for you. Appropriate quoting needs to happen. If you are involved in the billing services, you'll know what costs of supplies will be there, and you'll actually be able to bring value to the discussion. So make sure you get involved in the billing practices that are done for you and know what's going on. You'll also know who's being sent to collections and maybe who's getting bankrupted. As he mentioned, Dr. Eppley mentioned, many people are being bankrupted, not because the physician knew about it, but because of billing practices. So be sure and know what's going on. The next thing you need to get involved in is in your office management. Know your manager, your office manager or your administrator. They represent you on the phone. They're talking to patients. They're talking to insurance companies. You need to know and trust them. And there are many of us who tend to just say, well, that's their job, and I'm just going to come to work every day and not know what's going on. I'm going to let them interview the new employees who work in my front office, my MA, my nurse, and then they're going to, and then they'll bring them to me, and that'll be great. The problem is, once you get rid of that, all of a sudden you have somebody that you may not trust working for you. I'll tell you a story about a primary care physician friend of mine who I asked, well, how's it going in your practice? She's currently employed. She's currently a mother of two and busy with a lot of things. And she said to me, well, how much time do you have? And I said, well, what do you mean? She goes, well, first, I'm not happy because they've decided that a medical assistant is good enough for me and I don't need a nurse, you know, but I have complex problems for my patients. I need the nurse to be counseling on diabetes and on nutrition and all sorts of things. And the medical assistant, bless her heart, she's only had 6 months of training and she's just not up to doing all the things I need. And if I had a nurse, I would be much more productive and better able to take care of my patients. And I said, well, do you get to interview who is your nurse or who your MA is? And she says, no, I really don't get to do that. And then I said, well, what's going on with your MA now? And she goes, well, my MA quit in October, and I've had a different MA every day for the last 3 months. They're finally getting me a new MA, and I just went to her graduation, and so I'm teaching her what to do. But for 3 months, every day, I was teaching the MA what to do. And because I was doing that, my productivity went down, and guess what? The administrator or manager came to me and said, why is your productivity down? You need to be seeing more patients. And she said, well, you gave me this MA, and every day I got a new MA, and I couldn't get as much done because I was teaching her. So the bottom line is we need to be involved. We need to step up and say we can interview. I had a discussion with one of the healthcare systems this morning, and I said, your employed physicians, can they actually be in the process of interviewing their employees? And they said, yes, but most of them don't want to. And I said, well, I'm going to start talking to them today and say, make sure if you're not doing it, it's your own fault, because you need to find the right person for the job. I went back. I apologize. I like this quote from Steve Jobs. The only way to do great work is to love what you do. That physician who is an internist is not happy. She doesn't love what she's doing right now. Many of us went into medicine for a reason, because we love it. But when we get lost in the Accountable Care Act, we get lost in the business of corporate medicine, we lose sight of what we love to do. The great work is done between you and the patient. Take the time to make sure that you are doing what you need to do so that you can do great work and that you love it. because that's how we're going to be able to get things done. The next thing is community caucuses. Community caucuses, there is many things going on in your community, and physicians are looked up to as leaders. I went to my first neighborhood caucus meeting in March. I'm sad to say I didn't go before because it was interesting. There was only five or six of us there. They said, oh, why don't you be the state delegate? Why don't you be the county delegate? The county delegates choose the candidates that, you know, run for the county offices, and the state delegates choose the congressmen and the other candidates. And I just found out that, gosh, you know, we really need to be a part of this, because there's been many times that I've said, my parents have said, how can we have two lousy candidates? You know, can't we have better candidates to choose from? And the bottom line was, they're chosen in March and May, and if we're not involved in choosing that in that process, we deserve what we get when it comes election time. So take the time to know them. And if you become a county delegate or state delegate, the legislators up at our Capitol Hill will listen to you more, and you'll be able to help us to negotiate better. There was a couple of bills that went through, and I won't read all these details. You're welcome to. But the Utah Medical Association were co-sponsors or sponsors on both of these bills, and they went through without a problem because the UMA does have some good clout. The first one is basically a truth in advertising bill, which just basically means everybody should wear a badge. A patient should not be deceived by seeing a doctor of something else besides a physician, and credentials should be there. And that's going to happen. And then the pharmaceutical dispensing bill, Senator Vickers is a pharmacist, and he just wanted to make sure that doctors could dispense in their office if they follow the rules. And basically it just sets up that to start happening if you would like to dispense. Amelia Earhart says, the most difficult thing is the decision to act. The rest is merely tenacity. And that goes right with your quote about never, never give up. We really need to just get in and keep fighting and decide to act for our patients, for ourselves, for our practices. Another way to get involved is to pay Utah Medical PAC dues or American Medical PAC dues. That money does help us to have clout with our congressmen, with our legislators. We use that to help them with their campaigns. You could also pay your PAC dues out there with Sylvia, and we would love to have you be a part of that also. The last thing I want to mention before I summarize is, it is my belief, and I think it's the belief of many who set up the Affordable Care Act, that physician-led health care is very important. And that does not mean that non-physicians aren't important. Everybody's important in our health care plan. We need everybody to take care of all these millions of people. We need PAs, nurse practitioners, nurses, community centers, et cetera. We need them all. And that's the best way that we're going to be able to take care of the needs of the American public. But we need to set up physician-led healthcare. We need places for those people to go to physicians, to ask the hard questions, to get the help they need, not to manage their blood pressure or whatever, all the easy things, but to manage the hard things, okay? But if they have a hard question, they need some backup. Physicians have a lot of training. You all know that. The training needs to be put to work to lead others. One way you can improve your leadership skill, and you could register for the UMA leadership training. The first one's going to happen in the fall of 2014. We have received a leadership grant to do multiple leadership trainings, and it's going to be fall and spring. And they're going to be in conjunction with the University of Utah. They're going to pull in some business expertise. It's going to be physician-directed. You should get involved in becoming a physician leader in your community and in your clinics. Mark Twain says, 20 years from now, you'll be more disappointed by the things that you didn't do than by the ones you did do. So throw off the bowline, sail away from safe harbor, catch the trade winds in your sails, explore, dream, and discover. Change is here. We've got to change. We've got to figure out a better way of doing things. Do, as Mark Twain says, don't try and just live in the past. Go out, make something happen, get involved with your community, and get involved with other physician extenders to make a better healthcare system, both here in Ogden, here in Utah, and in the United States, and throughout the world. I appreciate, again, the opportunity to speak to you, and we'll be happy to entertain any questions. Thank you very much.
We'll ask you to go to the microphones, if you would, please, for questions. For those of you that live in Weber County, there is a Weber County Medical Society delegate training to the UMA House of Delegates, and that will be on July 9th at 6:30 at Ogden Regional. So I will ask for questions, and I'll turn this mic over to Ted. Go ahead, please.
This is a question for Dr. Epperle. Someone said that life is too short to make all of your own mistakes. We heard last night, I think, that some of the countries that enjoy a ranking above the 37th place of the United States are having problems of their own in digging out with current financial problems in those existing systems, as good as they appear to be. What are some of the lessons that we could learn from them and avoid some of those mistakes that they're making as we engage in this refining and further improvement of the system that we're going to be dealing with?
Okay, excellent question. First, in those countries, they also struggle in the sense of trying to get this thing dialed in. And it leads me to tell you that there, and I've done quite a bit of work on other countries' healthcare systems, there is no perfect healthcare system out there. And in fact, it's led to this grass is greener on the other side of the fence approach that many countries have. They're looking at other systems, seeing what works, so it's perfectly in alignment with what you said. One of the other truisms I've found with this is that doctors and hospitals never think they're making enough money. And that has been a truism across all the countries as well, so not unique just to us. The last of the three truisms that I've found from studying, you know, other countries' healthcare systems is the last reform measure is viewed pretty much by most people as having failed. So that, I think, is a great reminder to us that all the countries are in this performance improvement phase of trying to get this dialed in. With that said, to your question now specifically, I think some of the lessons learned that will really be helpful to the United States is, number one, understanding the value of coverage so that as many people as possible, again, having some degree of coverage. The reason for that is that it leads to a lot of security in their minds about knowing that they don't need to live sicker and die younger because they can't afford health care, and put off a lot of problems, and then when they get to extremis, they show up in an emergency room or into the hospital on fire, like the one slide is. So again, the understanding of basic coverage to as many people as possible has held up over time. The second, and I alluded to this too, and I'll stop with this, is again the importance of a usual source of care. The reason for that, and Stephen referred to this too, is the importance of relationships. If you have a relationship with someone you know and you trust, that is everything in regards to helping sort out questions and issues around your health care. And we need to put the patients really back into the center of this. It is and should be about them and their choices, and we should have that kind of relationship so we can help dial into that. Now, having said that, I'll just add one other thought, and that is that we need to incentivize our patients across this country to be engaged as well with this transformation effort. I have patients that can out-eat or out-drink any medication I'll ever put them on, and they've got to be part of the solution too. And so dialing into behavior change and helping incentivize that is important, but it won't happen if there's not a relationship with them.
This microphone, please.
Yes, would you mind putting that slide back up, the last quote by Mark Twain? It was pretty cool, just for a minute.
I have a question. I was very excited about the Affordable Health Care Act, thinking that I can get all my patients that have not had colonoscopies and mammograms. And now that I find out that they have these extraordinary deductibles, they still don't want to have their colonoscopy because they have a $7,000 deductible. And then I have some patients that simply have not signed up because it's too expensive. So to me, this is kind of an oxymoron, Affordable Care Act, but my patients can't afford it.
Yeah. Understand. Good question.
Yeah.
One of the provisions in the Affordable Care Act was to make all preventive services have no copays nor deductibles. So if it met Category B, United States Preventive Services Task Force criteria for evidence in terms of strength of recommendation, B or higher, B or A rating, then there is no copay, no deductible for that preventive service. So in regards to the colonoscopy patient, screening colonoscopy is felt to be a Category B provision. I don't know about the uniqueness of your particular patient, if there was some sort of, a polyp removed or some sort of electrocautery applied that would make it so expensive. But it does lead to one other point, and that is that there are a lot of procedures that are unbelievably overpriced. And when the RUC, which is the Relative Value Update Committee, priced colonoscopy, and I'll just use it as an example, they used it when the technology was less and it took longer. Liability issues factor into that. And there has been a tremendous improvement in both technology and time. The healthcare sector is the only sector in our economy where new technology increases prices and not decreases prices. So we've got a lot of work to do in terms of trying to dial that down, in terms of trying to right-size what a cost of a colonoscopy is. If you get outside the United States, no country charges the prices the United States does for a colonoscopy. And that can range anywhere from $75 for a colonoscopy to about $700 for a colonoscopy. And, I'm not sure what all is being charged here in Ogden, but I can tell you in Boise, Idaho, I've seen patients pay upwards to $5,000 for a colonoscopy. And that has to stop.
You know, what happened with his colonoscopy, he's went in, if you go in for a screening, it's a screening, they'll cover it. But if they go in there and they find a polyp, they pop the polyp up and it's no longer, it's a diagnostic. So it doubles the cost and the patient has to pay for it now.
Right.
So, I mean, who makes up these rules is what I want to know.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense. I mean, you don't know that when you go in there.
Yeah.
That you're going to have polyps, and a third of my patients have polyps.
Yeah, I hear that, and I, it leads to a point that there's work to be done on this. It's clearly not by any means perfect, and that's why I say the refinement and refocusing on this. I think it'll take 20 years to really dial this in, and there's stuff like that out there that isn't ideal, and that we do need to change.
Right.
Yeah, Ted, I just wonder, I have lived overseas. My son's over in grad school in Switzerland right now, getting really excellent medical care in that system. And I have old roommates from high school days in Austria that are physicians, that are part of the system in Vienna and small towns along the Danube. And they do very well. And But I think there's really a major difference between the American psych and the European psych in terms of their perspective on medicine, and basically, kind of to summarize it, we're just ravenous consumers of whatever we is put in front of us, whether it's new cars, houses, food, obesity. I don't think you can compare America to Germany or there's hardly any overweight people in Switzerland. You walk around, there's nobody with a BMI of 35. I mean, so I think the psych. in terms of the expectation, the sense that there's some finite to the systems and so forth over there. Obviously, they all have skin in the game. They're paying high taxes. I struggle with this. I think we need to cover for people, but I don't think we can do that in America, certainly with the current psych and the current system the way it is. And I just wonder if you have some insight into that.
Yeah, I do, and maybe Steve can add to this, too. You're absolutely right, Frank. You know, part of the issue is the American psyche. Our expectations, many of us, are that everything should be done, and we should have everything we want. I mean, it fits into both how the United States runs, but also what our expectations are of our country. And I do believe that there needs to be a culture change in regards to several things. First is the fundamental question, is healthcare a basic right? And if I were to ask a show of hands on how many of you think it's a basic right and how many people don't, I would almost predict the group will be almost 50% on each. That's kind of what America is at with this. So one thing that is true about our country is we've not resolved the basic issue of, is basic health care a right that all citizens in our country should have? One of the things that the industrialized countries outside the United States have decided, and I'm not trying to say it's right nor wrong, but they have a solidarity around the fact that basic health care is a right of every citizen in those countries. And with that basic question resolved, they've been able to then help design their healthcare systems around that. And that's something we fundamentally still struggle with in our country.
I just emphasize what you already said about end-of-life care and the need to answer the tough questions, which is also changing that psyche that grandma or mom or dad needs everything done, because that's just where all the healthcare dollars end up going. And then also I heard a great talk on the Swiss system, and that system works because insurance companies there, they have insurance. It's regulated, very much regulated. It says what they can do and what they can't do, and it's through regulation that they're able to do it.
I work for a week each month in an emergency room on an Indian reservation, and the sentiment of the Navajo people is that if one of their relatives dies in the home, they've got to burn down the home. They've got to just get rid of it. And so they've got to do everything they can to keep this relative alive, that it includes hospitalization. They absolutely don't want them at the end of life in their home. Now, I realize that a Dr. Kevorkian approach, or quote the death panels, creates a lot of emotion, but we spend so much money on futile end-of-life care, and at the same time, we have to recognize how terrible, terrible it would be if we couldn't die, if all we could do is age, but could not die. What is being done, or do you see approach in kind of educating the American public to let our elderly die?
Well, first, excellent question.
That are at the end of life, when care is recognized as futile. This is such a huge percentage of the money we spend. Okay, thank you.
Well, I'll make a comment, and I'm sure Steve has comments too on this one. You know, again, so much is cultural. The Navajo tribe, you're exactly right, and I'm aware of that for the Navajos. But, you know, the culture with many other people is to have a death that is acceptable within the home. I'll just share with you a quick story, and that's of my mother. So my mom developed stage 4 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, metastatic. My mom wanted to have as much done as was reasonable until a point in time when she recognized that it was going to be futile. I was an advocate for her, but not her physician. And that day came from my mom. We moved her into my house. My wife did a marvelous job, along with other family members and myself, in caring for her. And she had the type of death that she wanted. She was surrounded by people who loved her. She was dry. She was warm. We helped her with as much pain and anxiety as is possible, and my mom had a great passing. I personally want that kind of death, too. Now, if I get in a car accident driving back I-15 to the Salt Lake City airport to fly back to Boise tonight, I want the greatest health care that Salt Lake City can provide, or Ogden, depending on where I get hurt. But I'll tell you, if I develop metastatic stage 4 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma that's refractory to chemotherapy or pancreatic cancer metastatic like my father died from, I want to be dry and I want to be warm, and I do not want to be in an ICU with buzzers, beepers, and bells, and people who don't know me partially clad. I do not want that kind of death. And so to educate the communities, there are quite a few things that are happening. I'll just mention a short, quick story and an example. The Gunderson Clinic in Wisconsin, and out of the city of La Crosse, has put together a marvelous community effort where it is taken, the end-of-life discussion is taken off the back of the physicians in the community. And they've employed a tremendously well-educated lay public made up of educators, nurses, parish priests, teachers that have been trained as advanced care planners to go into the community, talk with people, and help have an ongoing dialogue with them at three stages in their life: early step planning, middle step once chronic diseases and life-changing diseases occur, and then late step planning in terms of how then the end starts to look. Because of that, they have 99% of the community understanding what it is that they want, and then advanced directives, so designated, so that the community's culture, as opposed to the Navajo culture, is for an understanding of the type of death and the type of choices that people want. This is about how you want to live, not necessarily how you want to die. And a lot of us, I think, do want that type of dignified death. I know in my personal practice, Brian, I'm sure, is probably can speak to that as well. Oftentimes, I'm too busy to really sit down and have the types of conversations. I try to insert them. I think the model needs to change, but I think that's the direction we should try to do for the good of all of our communities, quite frankly.
As we end our time, we again want to thank our sponsors, the Ogden Clinic, the National Kidney Foundation, and UAFP. One more question. Sorry, Rhonda. Last question. Go ahead, please.
I do have a question in regards. You talked earlier about basic right to health care and then individual wants, and I guess my biggest question is, especially when you were going amongst Congress and all these delegates, is at what point did the balance, I guess, of trying to provide health care for everybody trump an individual's right to choose? And I refer specifically to the individual mandate, where we're saying we want the best for the good of the nation, but at the same time that limits individual choice in regards to, does a person want or can't afford health insurance?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's why I went to the Supreme Court. Let me just share two thoughts. First, every single nation outside the United States has an individual mandate. There is no existing industrialized country that does not require their citizens to have some sort of health insurance. So we're alone with that. But it speaks to, and my second point, the American psyche again. We were founded as a country of rugged individualists. It's what, in many ways, have made America great. Many of the people that moved to my state of Idaho and your state of Utah were pioneers. And the pioneer spirit is to not be told what to do, is to figure out life through their lens and not necessarily a greater societal lens. So I think part of this is just America trying to figure out who we are, too, in terms of that. So you're exactly right. It is a fundamental question, is does individual choice trump societal good? And we still struggle with that. The Supreme Court decided, at least, and I'm not saying they were right or the wrong, but they did decide that at least that the individual mandate was constitutional.
Thank you all for joining us. We'll move out of the luncheon room now. Ted will be signing books at the University of Utah book-selling store right outside. Thank you to both our speakers.